This week's episode is sponsored by the podcast, Scary Time. Prepare yourself for the scariest, creepiest, and most terrifying stories and conversations. From the cursed tale of Griffith Park to Salem and the Bell Witch, there's something to get everybody's heart racing. Each weekly episode is hosted by a selection of the best content creators, and they cover cases such as paranormal hauntings, aliens, creepy places, strange phenomena, and everything in between. So wrap yourself up tight in bed, make sure your door is locked, and subscribe to Scary Time across all podcast platforms. The link is in my show notes. Before you go any further with this episode, I want you to download the free app Vodacast and listen to this episode there. Vodacast is a podcast player. What sets it apart from regular podcast players is that they provide deeper digital stories. For example, you could be listening to this episode on Vodacast and immerse yourself in some bonus content, such as photographs related to the case, including photographs of the victim and photographs of the criminal investigation, as well as links to newspaper articles and much more. As you listen on Vodacast, the bonus content appears at the appropriate time in the episode, so you could be listening about certain evidence and see it on your screen for yourself. I'm going to be mentioning certain things that you can see on Vodacast throughout this episode, so download the app now to make sure that you don't miss out. Just click the link in my show notes or search for Vodacast on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. Lawrence is a city of around 75,000 residents, situated near the New Hampshire border. In November of 2016, a teenage boy vanished from his grandmother's home. CCTV footage would capture him in the company of another teenage boy. His disappearance, as well as the outcome, would lead to many within the community questioning whether Lawrence police really did their job, and whether they had shrugged the teenager off as a runaway simply because he was Hispanic. On the 18th of November 2016, 16-year-old Lee Manuel Valoria Polino left his home in Lawrence, Massachusetts. It was a multi-family home filled with his uncles, mother, grandmother, and other relatives. At the time, Lee's mother, Cariasca Polino, was away in the Dominican Republic. When Lee didn't return home, his family became concerned. This fear escalated even further when it was noticed that Lee had left behind his mobile phone and his wallet in his bedroom, which was, of course, extremely out of character, especially for a teenager. The following morning, his family reported him missing. You can see the missing person poster on the Vodacast app. A search for the missing teenager was launched, as family pleaded on social media for information regarding Lee's whereabouts and canvassed the neighbourhood. According to family, as well as to friends, they didn't believe that Lee was a runaway. His friend, Andrew Lozano, who had known Lee since elementary school, said that Lee was always extremely happy and talkative. Lee was well known and well liked, and was always trusted to babysit the children in his family as well as children of his neighbours. He was kind and compassionate, and would always offer his sweater if anybody else was cold. Loved ones also said that Lee was somebody that you could count on, and somebody that you could trust with any secrets. Lee had a really soft side and enjoyed nothing more than good poetry. On the 30th of November, there was a grim discovery near the Merrimack River, just off Water Street. Discarded down a narrow lane which led to the river was the body of a young male, with his head and hands cut off. Nearby on the banks of the river was the decapitated head, just behind the Lawrence Boys and Girls Club. Fear immediately washed over Lee's family. While the body had not yet been identified, they rushed to McCabe Court in a bid to find some answers. They were extremely concerned that the decapitated body could have been Lee.
We discovered a body along the banks of the Merrimack River. Since that time, the Massachusetts State Police assigned to District Attorney Jonathan Blodgett's office, along with detectives from the Lawrence Police Department, have been working around the clock. Based on the information that we have, I believe that there is no further threat to the city of Lawrence. However, due to the nature of the investigation, I cannot elaborate any further, and I refer all questions to the District Attorney's office. Thank you.
Meanwhile, back at the grisly crime scene, darkness was fast approaching. The fire department was on scene with high-intensity lighting, which illuminated the area. Crime scene tape was cordoning a large area off as state and local detectives gathered at the scene, searching for any evidence. The body was transported to the medical examiner's office for an identification to be made, as well as a cause of death to be determined. The following day, Lee's family received the crushing news that the body had been identified, and it was Lee. The grueling autopsy had taken 11 hours to complete due to the plethora of horrific injuries which had been inflicted on Lee. Essex District Attorney Jonathan Blodgett said during a press conference that the gruesome discovery was a tragic loss for all of Lee's loved ones, adding that investigators were working tirelessly to determine who was responsible for the murder. Mayor Daniel Rivera also released a statement in which he revealed that investigators on the case already had promising information regarding the murder that would help them solve it and bring Lee's killer to justice. He urged anybody with any information into the murder to please get in contact with investigators or even the district attorney's office. That night, a vigil was held in honour of Lee at Lawrence High School. They gathered at the gates of the Lawrence High football field and lit candles and placed placards with messages to Lee. Over 100 candles lit up the front of the gate as students huddled together and sobbed. A number of Lee's friends would share their fond memories of the thoughtful teenager. One classmate spoke about how he calmed her down before a dance recital. She said, "I had really bad anxiety that day. It was really hard for me. He calmed you down very easily. It was just being next to him." Another classmate said that Lee had an amazing vibe, adding that even just being in his presence could make you feel a lot better. Another sophomore recalled how Lee often called her up just to check up on her. She said that she couldn't fathom why anybody would want to harm him, adding that whoever had killed Lee had no heart. During the vigil, Harmony Mendoza, a friend of Lee, read out a poem titled Woke, which had been written by Lee. You can see more about the vigil on the Vodacast app. Lee's aunt, Christy Michaud, described her nephew as kind-hearted and said that he'd been looking forward to taking a poetry-related field trip. She recollected how Lee would always help somebody in need, stating, "He helped an older lady on the side of the street one time, bringing in her groceries. He just stopped and helped her." Far too often when a teenager is murdered, rumours would begin to circulate that the murder was somehow gang or drug related. Christine said that she wanted everybody to know that Lee was genuinely a good boy who was loved deeply by his family and by all of his friends. Lee's family lambasted Lawrence Police for how they had handled the case in the beginning. His grandfather, Gustavo Polino, said that the police had treated Lee as a runaway, despite the family's persistence that Lee would never have run away from home. His grandmother, Evelise Corneille, said that Lawrence Police had only started to pay attention when state police became involved in this search. The family held their own personal vigil for Lee at the family's home. A lot of Lee's friends would echo the thoughts of Lee's family. His friend, Delaney Laura, spoke with the Eagle Tribune and said that she wondered if a Hispanic kid from Lawrence was not considered important enough to trigger a massive search. In fact, police didn't really do much to try and find Lee, and there was very limited information regarding his disappearance. It was really only until he was found dismembered that his disappearance was reported in the media. His mother would speak to the media.
To the mayor, to the chief of police, to every police officer, detective in our police department, if it was their kid, would they have waited 2 weeks to look for him?
After the grim discovery of Lee's body, the fear and heartache among the community was evident. The murder of any person is absolutely heinous, but for a teenager to be killed and then dismembered elicited strong emotions. One of Lee's classmates said to the Boston Herald, "The whole thing is scary. You never know, it could have been any one of our brothers. I have a lot of brothers I worry about every night." There were also a lot of rumours swirling around that Lee had been seen on the evening of his disappearance at the location where his body was found. Even more bizarre, he was reportedly seen in the company of another teenage boy. According to family friend Lynette Perez, "I know it's a kid from his high school, but I don't know who it is. The family doesn't know him. They think it's someone Lee had just met not too long ago." Just the following day, there was a break in the case when it was announced that a 15-year-old boy had been arrested and charged with the murder of Lee. He was identified as Matthew Borges, a classmate of Lee at Lawrence High School, and he had been charged as an adult. District Attorney Blodgett revealed that Matthew was arrested after state police and Lawrence police executed a search warrant of his home on Oxford Street. He said that Matthew was arrested based on evidence which was found in his home. However, he refused to elaborate any further. As news of the arrest swept throughout the area, Lee's family gathered to share their frustration at how the case was handled. His grandmother said that if investigators had only paid attention to them 2 weeks earlier when Lee went missing, then maybe the outcome could have been different. She said that if the family were white and had money, she believed that the case would have been handled much differently. His grandfather, Gustavo, stated, "Our boy did not run in the streets. We said to the police that he would never run away. Why did it take so long for them to believe us?" Matthew appeared in court the following morning to be charged with the murder of Lee. It would be revealed that a witness had told investigators that Matthew had told him that he had done something bad. When the witness pushed for more information, Matthew said that he had stabbed a kid and then cut his head off, killing him. According to the witness, when Matthew said this, he was motioning with his hands as if he were stabbing someone and cutting someone's head off. It would also be revealed that CCTV from a neighbour's home had captured Lee leaving his home with Matthew on the evening of his disappearance. You can see the CCTV footage up on the Vodacast app. When Matthew was initially questioned by investigators when he was identified as the other teenager in the footage, he had said that he and Lee had walked to the Merrimack River so that they could smoke some weed together. He described the route they had allegedly taken to get to the river, as well as the point where they stopped for a smoke. According to Matthew, both he and Lee liked nature, and they liked the way the boathouse across the river lit up at nighttime. Matthew claimed that he left Lee alone down by the river at around 7 p.m. and walked home alone.
"Well, that day I went to school. It was a regular day. Saw Lee at lunch. And then after lunch I went home and we left to the river to smoke. After that, it was like 6:30. We were still smoking and I left around 6:45 to 7.
Did you expect him to go home that night?
Yeah.
Okay, so... yeah, so it was, when did you find out that...
When Lee... I was at work the next day. Before I went to work, the girl I always talked to told me, she said, "Have you seen Lee?" I was like, "Yeah, I was with him the other day." And I was like, "Why, what happened?" She said, "He's missing." I was like, "Wow."
Matthew pleaded not guilty to the murder and would be ordered to be held without bail due to the severity of the crime he had been accused of. Since he was charged as an adult, he would be facing indictment by the Essex County Grand Jury, and then the case would be transferred to Superior Court, where if he were found guilty, the penalty would be much more severe than if convicted in juvenile court. Outside of court, Matthew's defence attorney, Edward Hayden, described his client as a good student who held down a part-time job. He said he didn't know enough about the case yet to comment other than to say that Matthew was holding up as well as could be expected, given the circumstances. A friend of Matthew, Nerys Medina, also described Matthew as a nice person outside of court and said that he suspected that he was actually innocent and was covering for the person who actually killed Lee. Classmates, however, would paint a very different picture of Matthew. They described him as troubled and said that he was constantly getting into trouble at school and had a tough background. Classmates had shared their surprise over Matthew's arrest, stating that Lee and Matthew appeared to be close friends, who frequently hung out together and smoked weed. One classmate said that after Lee went missing, Matthew's reaction really bothered him. He said that when people spoke about Lee and their concern for his welfare, Matthew showed no emotion, which was peculiar because they were friends and they were close. This same teenager said that Matthew had a really short fuse and had evident anger problems. There were some other classmates who said that while Matthew was troubled, he was also very intelligent. One classmate said that if she ever needed help in class, Matthew would offer his assistance. She said, "He's a gentleman. He's quiet. He's talkative too, but he's always quiet in class." Court documents would show that Lawrence police had been called to Matthew's home back in 2011 for a domestic violence report. His father had been accused of slapping a woman, but the case was later dismissed. Matthew was the oldest of five children, and his parents were noticeably absent from the arraignment. Just the day after the arraignment, Lawrence Police Chief James Fitzpatrick defended their investigation into the disappearance of Lee. He said that initially they had considered Lee a runaway, based on reported sighting of Lee, which would turn out to be false. However, they said that they had made the case a priority from the very beginning, stating, "We were relentless on this case." Mayor Rivera said that he would be standing by the police, but revealed that he may consider an independent review of the case. City councillors Modesto Maldonado and Brian DePina would call on Chief Fitzpatrick to resign and would criticise his handling of the case, alleging that he did very little to search for Lee. DePina said that his failure to respond effectively to pleas from Lee's family to join the search fit into what he said was Chief Fitzpatrick's ineffective record of fighting crime. Mayor Rivera would then announce that he would be organising an independent review of how the case was handled by police. This independent review would be led by a team of investigators who had experience in public safety. He said that the community demanded the independent review and that he hoped it would show that there was little difference between what is supposed to happen and what they wished would have happened. While Mayor Rivera was organising the independent review, he criticised Maldonado and DePina for calling on Chief Fitzpatrick to resign. He accused them of both exploiting a tragedy for political points. At the time, they were about to announce their run for mayor, and just days later, that's what Maldonado did, announced that he was running for mayor. In an interview, he suggested that police in Lawrence were mistrusted by the community and considered distant and unapproachable. DePina would then state the police had failed to immediately chase up a tip, which was provided by Lee's family. As it would turn out, this tip that was provided by the family was the CCTV footage which showed Lee and Matthew leaving the residence. He accused them of waiting 8 days to start doing something. I've recently become obsessed with Foreo and they've sponsored this episode. Foreo exists to reinvent beauty and wellness by offering innovative devices that install confidence and improve your skin. I've been using the Luna 3, which features thin touch points for cleansing your face. I've also been using the UFO Mini, which is a 90-second face treatment utilizing hyper-infusion technology. It leaves my skin glowing and radiant in just 90 seconds. I have quite sensitive skin, and 4AO genuinely leaves my skin feeling amazing. I've also been using the massage function on Luna 3, which directs lower frequency pulsations to wrinkle-prone areas and smooths the appearance of fine lines. I've been doing this for a couple of weeks now and already see a difference in the look and feel of my skin. 4AO are offering Morbidology listeners an Amazon bundle, which includes the Luna 3, the UFO Mini, and Call It a Night UFO activated mask. The set is valued at $307.99 and retails on Amazon at $249. But with the code MORBID50, you can get it for $199. There are two other bundles, but that's the one I've got. It's been a tough year and a half for all of us, and it's about time we deserve to have that moment of pampering zen. I swear by their products now and use them every single day. Just click the link in my show notes to the Amazon bundles, or go to 4AO's Amazon shop and click the bundles tab and use code MORBID50 for 35% off. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and their today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counselling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counselling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counselling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counsellors specialising in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counsellor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. The city would really unite in the wake of the disturbing murder. And once again, they would gather at Lawrence High School to remember Lee. His name was spelled out in candles as around 400 people gathered to commemorate his short life. They offered prayers, sang, and gave speeches. They had wanted to show Lee's family that the community was there for them and united behind them. Gabriel Gonzalez Sr., whose son, Gabriel Jr., was murdered in 2009, held up a sign which read, "The violence of Lawrence stole my son." GoFundMe would be set up for donations to go to Lee's family, to assist in funeral and legal expenses that they would be forced to incur. Very quickly, the donation swelled to over $10,000, and it was announced that additional funds would be going towards a scholarship for a student from Lawrence High School. Lee's half-sister, Alexander Berdier, would share with the world a really heartbreaking conversation she had with her brother via text message around a week before his disappearance. She said that he had gone to a sweet 16th birthday party, but shortly after arriving at the party, he left and sat outside alone and texted his sister, "I have no friends. It feels like I'm a bother." Alexandra said that she texted back that she was happy, that he was her brother, and that she often felt the same as he did that night, alone and depressed. She said that she had been mentally preparing for his funeral, which was scheduled for the Friday. She told the Eagle Tribune, "It's going to destroy me. He was my best friend. It was the best connection I ever made in my life." She expressed her grief that Lee's life was being overshadowed by the glare of the murder investigation, as well as the political moves. Before Lee's funeral, his family were given a large poster board by 15-year-old Najalis Gonzalez. She and dozens of other students at Lorne High School had signed the poster board with messages such as, "Loved by many, forgotten by none," and "May angels carry you." There was a four-hour wake at the Farah Funeral Home, where mourners prayed in front of Lee's white casket. The poster board was displayed along vases, filled with flowers and photographs of Lee throughout his life. Hundreds of people would arrive to pay their respects. They wanted to remember Lee's joy-filled life, as opposed to the cruel manner in which he had been taken. A number of people in attendance shared their fond memories of Lee, such as his first teacher at Head Start, who recollected how she used to call Lee and his two best friends, the Three Musketeers, because they were always together. A couple of days after the funeral, a longtime member of the Lawrence Police Department was fired for criticising how the disappearance of Lee was handled. William Green had posted a 25-minute video to YouTube, during which he called the investigation inadequate and said that the department wasn't prepared. He said during the video that he was speaking as a resident of Lawrence and said that his opinions did not represent the police department. Mayor Rivera responded to the video in a Facebook post of his own, in which he complained of an unnamed, crazed rogue police officer, stating, "I'm coming for you." Shortly thereafter, Mayor Rivera confirmed that the officer had been fired. A probable cause hearing was scheduled for the case for the end of January. However, the hearing never went ahead. Instead, prosecutor James Gubitos asked Judge Michael Alaric to impound discovery or potential evidence. The judge granted the motion, which is a protective order which prevented Matthew's defense attorney from providing anybody, including the defendant, with copies of the discovery which had been provided. This protective order also barred his defense from providing Matthew or anybody other than his investigator with the location and personal information of a civilian witness in the case. Matthew's defense also filed motions in the case which included a request to hire an investigator as well as a psychologist to help in the defense. After the court hearing, Defence Hayden would speak with the Boston Herald to say that he found it difficult to reconcile the polite teenager he had come to know with the gruesome murder that he had been accused of. He said that Matthew was an easy client to work with and that he was concerned about his future. In early March, Matthew was formally indicted in the first-degree murder charge by a grand jury. The indictment alleged that Matthew did assault and beat Lee Manuel Paulino with intent to murder him, and by such assault and beating did kill and murder Lee Manuel Paulino. The indictment meant that the case would now be transferred from Lawrence District Court to Salem Superior Court. By this point in the case, the cause of death had not yet been disclosed. It was evident that Lee had been murdered, but it wasn't known whether he had been beheaded and dismembered after death, or if that was the ultimate cause of death. Following the indictment, District Attorney Blodgett blocked the independent review into the police's handling of the case, citing concerns that it could jeopardise his prosecution of Matthew. The lawyer who was leading the independent review, Angel Tavera, said that the investigation had hit a roadblock immediately anyway, because District Attorney Blodgett had asked Chief Fitzpatrick to forbid the officers who were involved in the search from talking to investigators about it. In the district attorney's letter to the chief, he wrote, "I am concerned that police officers' answers to inquiries will likely compromise the confidentiality of the ongoing criminal investigation, potentially breach any secrecy and violate a district court order in pointing the search warrant materials in this investigation. As you are aware, such breaches could ultimately jeopardise the outcome of the criminal investigation and prosecution." He said the independent review would resume when the prosecution of Matthew was completed. In June, it would be publicly revealed that the pathologist who had conducted Lee's autopsy had still not issued an autopsy report. Defence Hayden lambasted the pathologist, stating that he had never seen an autopsy report take more than 6 months to get completed. His concern was echoed by prosecutor Gubitos. When Lee's death certificate was issued, it listed his cause and manner of death as pending. After being pushed by both the prosecution and the defence, the pathologist completed the autopsy report and it would be presented during the upcoming murder trial. Shortly thereafter, Defence Hayden filed a number of motions, including a request to the prosecution for a bill of particulars, which basically means more detailed information into the crime that Matthew allegedly committed. He wanted to know specifically whether the state believed that Matthew acted alone or had help in the murder of Lee. He also wanted more information on witnesses that had been interviewed by investigators on the case, stating that one of the investigators had allegedly told a witness that they had interviewed at least 50 people, but said that he only had the names of 20 witnesses, not 50. Defence Hayden was also seeking to suppress statements that Matthew had made to police. According to the affidavit, Matthew said that he was home alone when police arrived at his home and questioned him. He said, "I did not think I could tell them to leave. He did not speak to my mother or father before asking me questions. He did not give any warning about my right not to speak to him." He said that police asked him to accompany them to the river, which he eventually did, stating, "I told the police that I would go with them because I was afraid of what would happen if I said no." While the case was slowly making progress in the courts, Lee's friends and family still knew very little about the case. For one, they didn't even know how Lee had been killed, and they didn't know the motivation behind the murder. In mid-September, around 100 of Lee's loved ones gathered on the Campagnone Common to keep his memory alive and demand justice. Most in attendance wore black t-shirts emblazoned with Lee's face on the front. On the back were the words, "We want answers. We need answers. We need justice." They expressed their frustration with the slow pace of the justice system and shared their fears that Matthew didn't act alone. City Councillor Modesto and former mayor William Lantigua, who were both running for mayor, were at the vigil wearing t-shirts demanding for justice. Mayor Rivera was noticeably absent. Early the following year, Defence Hayden would also attempt to get police seizure of Matthew's mobile phone, tossed from evidence. According to Matthew, he did not consent to having law enforcement seize and retain his mobile phone or search his phone records. According to Defence Hayden, when Matthew was initially questioned by investigators, he agreed to let them look at his phone, but not to take it away overnight. His phone was held by investigators for 10 days, during which they obtained a search warrant and recovered evidence which they wanted to use during the murder trial. Defence Hayden was alleging that the mobile phone had been seized illegally and that there was no probable cause, no warrant not pursuant, to a lawful stop and frisk. Judge James Lang would deny the request, and the case was scheduled to go to trial on the 10th of September 2018. Just the month before the trial was to begin, Lee's family would be hit with another tragedy when his father, Felix Dario Berdier, was robbed, shot, and killed in the Vega Alta area of Puerto Rico. The trial date would then be pushed back until November, before being pushed back once more until April of 2019. According to his defence, they were still awaiting requested records, which had caused a delay in the case. On the 28th of April 2019, the murder trial finally began. During the opening statements, Prosecutor Gubatos told the jury that on the evening of the 18th of November 2016, Matthew and a group of other teenagers had gone to Lee's home to rob him of video games, clothes and belts. He said that CCTV footage showed Lee and Matthew leaving the residence, and moments later, four figures were seen going into Lee's home and exiting a short time later with duffel bags. He said that Matthew murdered his classmate and cut off his head and hands. He suggested that Matthew had been motivated to kill Lee because of jealousy, stating that Matthew had believed that Lee had slept with his ex-girlfriend. He revealed that in Matthew's bedroom, investigators had found a book in which he had written an ominous note.
"Go chill with him at his crib alone. Drink, smoke, and play it off. Kill him. Bring duffel bag, wear gloves, clean up mess, wear bags on shoes, wear clothes you don't care about."
He went on to say that during the trial, they would be presenting a plethora of evidence against Matthew, including text messages, Facebook messages, and surveillance footage. Defence attorney Ed Hayden, however, urged the jurors during his opening statement to be suspicious. He said that Matthew was guilty of a break-in, but not of a murder, and he stressed that the witnesses the prosecution were going to present were unreliable. claimed that the prosecution had no murder weapon, no tool used for dismemberment, no blood, no fingerprints, and no DNA. He said that Matthew was tough on the outside, but was insecure on the inside, and said that when he saw Lee and his ex-girlfriend eating lunch together shortly before the murder, he became angry. He spoke about the note that the prosecution had mentioned during their opening statements, highlighting the fact that Matthew never got rid of it.
It shows that he does not have any consciousness of guilt about that note because it doesn't apply to whatever happened to Lee. He didn't do it.
You can see more about the opening statements on the Vodacast app. Two teenage girls who knew Matthew were the first witnesses to testify. Leilani DeJesus, who had dated Matthew for 9 months before breaking up in August of 2016, said that Matthew had shouted at her and Lee as they ate lunch together at Lawrence High School shortly before the murder. She said that he became so irate that he needed to be escorted from the lunch room by a dean. She said that Matthew was evidently jealous of her friendship with Lee, and said that when they broke up, Matthew gave her a list of boys who he thought that she had slept with. Lee was included on that list of names. However, under cross-examination by the defence, she admitted that she had never said to investigators that Matthew was jealous. She also said that the following day, Matthew apologised to both her and Lee, adding that she had never seen Matthew physically fight with anybody else. Stephanie Soriano was then called to the witness stand. She spoke about her budding relationship with Matthew and the several months they had spent texting back and forth and messaging on Facebook. She testified that she was also good friends with Lee, who she described as similar to bright sunshine. In one of the messages Matthew had sent to Stephanie, he said that he had thought about killing somebody, stating, "I like the sound of it." He wrote, "I'll hide in the back of my mind, like always, and wait for the day I go truly insane." Then just one day before the murder, Matthew had texted Stephanie, "My eyes will look dead soon. Take a good look at my eyes. The next time we talk, people will notice a big difference in me once my eyes turn dead." Their testimony would be followed by testimony from Lee's grandmother, Evelise, who emotionally recollected the last interaction she had with her grandson through an interpreter. She said that Lee would always come home from school and ask what was cooking, adding that he always loved the smell of her kitchen. She said that she liked to have food ready for Lee when he arrived home from school, and that afternoon she had cooked him white rice, kidney beans, beef stew, fried eggplant and sweet plantains. She said that he ate 2 helpings and spoke about the trouble he was having with his homework. She became emotional as she said that this was the last time she ever saw her grandson. She described how Lee was always happy and was always singing. She said he would always kiss her each day and tell her how much he loved her. Other family members testified about the frantic search for Lee. His uncle, Samuel Polino, testified that when he came home from work that night, he told his mother that he had just seen 2 teenagers in their backyard. He said that he confronted one of the boys, but he just continued walking. Samuel, first of all, thought that maybe Lee had snuck out of the house and piled pots, pans, and a curtain rod on top of the day bed and rolled it in front of the door, thinking that if Lee tried to sneak back in, then he would catch him. Of course, Lee never returned home. Testimony would also be heard from Omar Medina and Leda Feliciano, who had discovered Lee's dismembered body. Omar lived near the river and he often walked his dog on the path along the riverbank. Typically, he said that his dog would stick to the path. However, this time, the dog veered off left, and when Omar whistled and called for her to come back, she did not return.
As I approached, I got closer. I saw her really sniffing at a particular area. So I pulled her back, and when I looked, I kind of second-guessed myself. You know, I thought I saw a dead body, but I wasn't too sure because, you know, was missing some limbs.
He said that he went off to try and find his dog. He found her sniffing at a particular area and tried to pull her back, but in doing so, He caught a glimpse of what she had been sniffing at. After finding the dismembered body, he said that he went back to the path to get his wife. She testified that as she approached the body, she first of all thought that it was a mannequin. However, it soon became apparent that it was a dismembered body. The Trials of Frank Carson is an amazing new true crime podcast brought to you by LA Times and the reporter behind Dirty John and Detective Trap. Frank Carson was a defense attorney who was famously known for his caustic behavior towards authority, and he strongly fought against a system which he believed was broken. However, things changed drastically when he became embroiled in a murder that he was named the main suspect of. He would claim that he was being set up by the district attorney and the police as payback. The trials of Frank Carson offer a very chilling insight into corruption, and it highlights some issues within the justice system that really need to be changed. I cannot recommend it enough. Listen and subscribe now to The Trials of Frank Carson on latimes.com, or listen and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you get podcasts. State Police Sergeant Brian O'Neill testified that while they were conducting a search of the crime scene, he found Lee's decapitated head in a plastic market basket bag in the water on the edge of the river just before dusk. He said that he used two sticks to retrieve the plastic bag from the water and then looked inside. He told the jury, "I opened it enough so that I could notice an ear." Graphic photographs were shown to the jurors of the dismembered body as well as the decapitated head. Police Detective Barry Bajarnas, a forensic video expert, would also testify about CCTV footage, which would be presented to the jury. CCTV footage had captured Lee returning from school that afternoon at 3:36 p.m. Half an hour later, CCTV footage would capture Matthew outside Lee's home. Then at 5:40 p.m., CCTV footage would capture Lee and Matthew walking on Haver Hill and Margin Street on their way to the river. From 6:04 p.m. to 6:11 p.m., CCTV captured four males going in and out of Lee's home with duffel bags. Lawrence Detective Kevin Chiavone told the jury that they were able to identify Matthew from the CCTV footage. They went to his home where he was home alone from school. Matthew told the investigators that he didn't know where Lee was, suggesting that maybe he had run away from home or was hiding out somewhere.
He respected me, I respected him. It was just, you know.
We don't know. So just, yeah, what's your opinion?
My opinion, he's probably hiding out somewhere.
Do you think like one of his friends' place?
Mm-hmm.
Matthew told Detective Chiavone that he and Lee were business associates and that Lee sold weed and that they had gotten together on the 18th of November to smoke weed at Lee's home. However, he said that some members of Lee's family were home. According to Matthew, they decided they would walk down by the river to smoke some weed, talk, and look at the lights. The detective said that while questioning Matthew, he noticed that he had cuts on his hands. When asked about them, Matthew said that he had cut himself in a fight in the south side of the city. However, moments later, he instead claimed that the cuts had come from changing bike parts. On the third day of the trial, there would be explosive testimony from 18-year-old Jonathan Miranda. He said that the plan for that evening was for Matthew to distract Lee so that he and a group of their friends could break into his home and rob it. He said to the jury, everyone was in on the plan. However, he said that Matthew later called him and the other teenagers to reveal that he had stabbed and beheaded Lee, adding that he had beheaded him and cut off his hands so that he couldn't be identified via appearance or via fingerprints. According to Jonathan, everybody got nervous and ran back home, with Jonathan leaving whatever items he had stolen behind. During cross-examination by Defence Hayden, Jonathan said that he didn't immediately go to police because he was afraid of going to jail for a murder that he did not commit, and also accused him of not being consistent with his story.
He told me that he killed Lee and cut off his head.
You told us that Matthew told you that he killed Lee.
Yes.
but you don't know when he told you that.
I don't know the exact one, but yeah.
You don't know where he told you that.
Angel Bandicourt, another one of the group who had broken into Lee's home, was also called as a witness during the trial. He reiterated what Jonathan had already said, that the plan was for Matthew to distract Lee. He said that he had stolen some clothing as well as a PlayStation, and that afterwards the teenagers went to one of the teenagers' homes. It was here that they received the phone call from Matthew. Angel testified, "It started off with, my hands were bloody. He came at me the wrong way, so I did what I had to do." Angel had initially lied to investigators about his role in the robbery, first of all claiming that he was lookout. Despite this, he did not face any criminal charges. Angel's 17-year-old brother would also be called to testify. He too had been at Lee's home and had heard the confession from Matthew.
"I heard him say he's dead, and then after that everything just blanked out."
The fourth teenager at the home would also be called as a witness. 18-year-old Julius Polino said that when Matthew called to report that he had murdered Lee, he sounded scared and as if he were crying.
"I heard him, he said he killed him."
How was he speaking? Do you remember anything about his voice?
"Scared, crying."
The phone call had been on speaker, so all four of the teenagers had heard the confession. He also said that a couple of days later, Matthew confessed in more detail to him.
"Did he tell you why he stabbed him in the throat?"
"Yeah."
"Why did he say that?"
Because he wouldn't shut up.
According to Julius, Matthew had said to him that he stabbed Lee over and over again on his stomach, back, and his throat, stating that he wouldn't shut up. He said that eventually, Lee gave up. He said that he didn't tell police about the confession immediately, but would eventually do so when being questioned by police. 11 days after Lee was reported missing, Matthew was brought down to the police station for questioning once again. This time, he had brought along his father, Hector Alicea. He was read his Miranda rights and reminded of his right to remain silent. During this interview, Matthew claimed that he left Lee down the riverbank alone after smoking weed. However, during his initial interview, he claimed that Lee had left him down at the riverbank alone. During this interview, Matthew becomes annoyed by the line of questioning, stating, "You're asking me questions about people I've never seen before." Detective Jay Hegarty then becomes more forceful and states, "The story doesn't sound too good."
"Matt, I've been in interviews for 7 straight hours with people, and they lied for 6.5 and 59 minutes of them, and then the last minute of the interview, they tell the truth."
"Okay."
"Okay? You yourself said the other day, this story really doesn't sound too good."
"Mm-hmm."
Under cross-examination, Detective Hegarty spoke about going down to the riverbank with Matthew. He acknowledged that Matthew didn't try to limit where they looked, and admitted that when they searched Matthew's home, they found no blood whatsoever. Facebook evidence would also be presented during trial. Less than a month before Lee went missing, Matthew had posted into a Facebook message group, "Guys, I'm going to kill someone on Halloween. I'm not lying. So if you hear someone dead on the news, we know. I just want to say that y'all fucker is going to look at me different." Detective Angel Meja told jurors that he was able to access the message from the private Facebook message group titled Game Winners through another teenager's cell phone. Matthew had asked members of the group to delete that specific message. Under cross-examination by the defense, Detective Meja was asked whether anything in the chat was nothing more than banter. He acknowledged that there were messages about shooting up a school, sniping Santa Claus, threatening suicide, and making proclamations about their sexual orientation. On the second week of the trial, evidence regarding Lee's cause of death was presented. Dr. Maria Del Mar Cabo Martinez testified that Lee had been stabbed 76 times, at least 30 of which were inflicted before he died.
"When we opened the body bag, there was a decapitated body with no hands. There was a separate body bag with a head. Major blood vessels and structures of the neck were severed to remove the head. There's just too much hemorrhage in that area to really know if the person was alive or dead at the time.
She revealed that his cause of death was multiple sharp force injuries. The wounds were both deep stab wounds and incise wounds, which are shallower. He had stab wounds to her lung, his kidney, his diaphragm and chest cavity. She said that she could not determine whether the wounds to Lee's neck had been inflicted before or after death. She stated, "Major blood vessels and structures of the neck were severed to remove the head. There's just too much hemorrhage in that area to really know if the person was alive or dead at the time." Phone evidence would also be entered as evidence. FBI agent Ryan Burke testified that Matthew's phone pinged to the cell phone tower near the Boys and Girls Club, which was where Lee's body had been found, four times on the 18th of November. A number of text messages would also be presented to the jury. In a text message from the 7th of November, Matthew had texted Stephanie, who he had a crush on, "You went and said hi to Lee, but not me." The following day, he texted her saying that he didn't know if he would ever ask her on a date because of her guy friends. In later text messages, he showed concern that he and Stephanie were not communicating enough, and one day he questioned why it took her so long to get home from school, and even accused her of being with a side guy. A number of text messages would also be presented which showed how possessive Matthew was. In one message, he told Stephanie to shut the fuck up and told her that she must do as he says. She asked him why he was behaving in that way, to which he replied, "I would kill any fucker who gets in the way of what I want." It was also revealed that in the days before Lee vanished, there were 61 text messages back and forth between him and Matthew. Matthew's defense team called no witnesses, and Matthew didn't testify on his own behalf. After all of the evidence was presented, it was now time for closing arguments. Prosecutor Gubatos held up a photograph of Lee smiling. He said that Matthew had taken everything Lee was, and everything he was ever going to be. According to the prosecution, Matthew had the means, motive, and opportunity to kill Lee, stating, "As scary as it is, the case is right in front of you. He killed Lee." Defense Hayden asked the jury to disregard every single thing that the four teenage witnesses who robbed Lee's house said. He said that they were all liars and that Matthew was their stay out of jail card. None of the teenagers faced any charges for their role in the break-in or for the lies they had said during the investigation. He said, "None of them had the presence of mind to call 911, even anonymously, and none of these kids went to the river to see if a body was there. That's not believable." He said that there were too many unreliable witnesses and unanswered questions in the case, adding that the four teenagers were Lauren's kids who didn't spend their time at church or at the library. He said he found it unbelievable that they were paralyzed by fear. The jury were then sent away to deliberate. After deliberating for less than 9 hours, they would find Matthew Borges guilty of the murder of Lee Manuel Valoria Polino. As the verdict was read out, Matthew showed no semblance of emotion. Defense Hayden said that they were disappointed with the outcome, but accepted that Matthew had received a fair trial. Lee's family, who had attended every single day of the trial, consoled one another. Nobody in Matthew's family had attended the trial. 2 months after the verdict, Matthew was back in court to be sentenced. Lee's mother gave an impassioned victim impact statement.
"On November 18, 2016, our world was irreversibly changed when Lee Manuel was taken from us. He was just 16 years old when he was murdered. And every day we struggle with the fact that his life was cut too short when he was in the cusp of so much. But that wasn't enough for the criminal that took his life. As found by the jury through the evidence presented in this trial, Lee Manuel's murder was not only premeditated, but carried out with extreme atrocity and cruelty. In the weeks before his remains were found and the years leading up to his conviction, we drove ourselves crazy trying to make sense of what had been done. We have wondered hopelessly, what could we have done differently, and tried to understand why someone would plan to commit such a horrible crime to such an amazing person. We were also assassinated because Lee was everything for this family. It was my firstborn, Gustavo Nivalis's first grandchild, and Samuel and Julique's first nephew. Limonel has always been immensely important to us, but now with him gone, we feel like we can't breathe. Limonel was and will continue to be our oxygen. He has been the soul of this family since he was born. And in spite of us standing here today, we're living dead after he was brutally ripped from our side. Despite whatever sentence is decided upon, we understand that nothing will bring Limonel back to us. However, we feel that this criminal deserves to spend his life incarcerated. So at very least, it serves to keep him off the streets. He should never have the opportunity to kill again, to rob another person of their life like he did to Limonel in such a horrible and sad way. We hope that the sentence handed down serves to help him find remorse and repentance in his life. We reaffirm that the assassin of Limonel Villar Paulino should receive the maximum sentence.
Matthew's defense team argued for a more lenient sentence, and while acknowledging that the crime was horrific, he said that nobody could predict what kind of person Matthew would be by the time he is eligible for parole. He stated, "He is not irredeemably depraved. There is hope for his redemption. He can change his life." Matthew was given the opportunity to address the court but declined. He would be handed a life sentence with a minimum of 30 years.
There are no more dreams for the dreamer, the brother, the writer, and the poet that was Limonel Villar Paulino, because the minds of this criminal landed on him as a target and decided to take his life. There are no more trips to us with Lee, and there's no more happy home projects if we cannot include him. Our lovely one, Limonel, was the driving force behind so many of the activities we used to do and loved, bringing the family together. Sharing a meal as a family was one of his favorite things. And because of this, he always looked forward to Thanksgiving celebration. We will never again have a Thanksgiving dinner because Limonel was torn from our arms just a few days before Thanksgiving of 2016. Limonel Villar Paulino was a great servant at our church where he volunteered full of love and dedication. Everybody there misses him dearly. He put his soul in the last activity they had about a month before his tragedy, where he painted more than 120 glasses with a beautiful, positive message to the youth.
When it comes to missing children and missing teenagers, time truly is paramount. The disappearance and subsequent murder of Lee Manuel Valoria Paulino showed that more needed to be done in police departments to better respond to reports of missing children and teenagers. While a speedy response would not have saved Lee's life, it very likely would have led to his body being found more swiftly and saved his family almost 3 weeks of uncertainty. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Emily, Jessica, Blaze, and Helen. If you'd like to support the show on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In return for your support, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platform, one of which was published last week. Merch, ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes, including bonus audio and case files, and much, much more. Go but I ask a huge favour and ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Lady Justice. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hello, my lovelies. My name is Chantelle, and I'm the host over at Lady Justice True Crime. Lady Justice is a weekly podcast that covers fascinating cases, both past and present, from around the UK and Ireland. Some of them are strange, many are unbelievable, all of them are completely unique and are someone's story. So please come join me on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.